Good morning. I am calling to order the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and I'm going to have the clerk take the roll. I think this will be an especially fulfilling taking of the roll today. Madam Clerk.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Katizawatuan, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bonner.
Present.
Representative Damath.
Present.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Wasilewicz.
Here.
Representative West.
Here.
And we have a quorum. I think that's the first time we've had all of us here at the beginning of the hearing, including me. So, impressive. Then we've got the minutes from our March 26th meeting, and if I can have a motion to approve the minutes. From someone? Anyone?
So moved.
Representative Bonner moves approval of the March 26th minutes. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the March 26th minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, we have that. Have those minutes approved, and so then, members, to our order of business, main order of business for today, which is our two division reports. I'm going to take House File 2610 back up for referral to for passage, I suppose, to our next. I'm not sure if that's which term that I use, but in any case, to our Health and Human Services Finance Division. We have several amendments. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, good point. It's education finance. So House File 2610 for referral to Education Finance Division. We will start by working through the amendments that have been offered and are posted, and then I'm going to offer the 8A8 amendment. And so I can just describe what that relates to. We heard testimony on Tuesday about the provision in the bill, I think relatively early in it, to on page one, towards the bottom of the page, having requiring the assignment of a qualified teacher to provide instruction in early education programs in schools. We heard some concern about the scope of that. And the need for some tailoring, other concerns as well. And so what the amendment does is it provides some modifications to the language to make clear that we're talking about when a district or charter school is operating the program itself, and then a delayed time horizon for compliance. So any discussion regarding the A8 amendment? Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is more kind of a global question about this issue in general, because I know that the importance of this amendment was that we know that there's a lot of programs out there that don't have somebody in the program that's licensed or on a track to be licensed, but that we are also still trying to provide high-quality child care. And we know that also that we heard the testimony, too, that talked about the value of high-quality child care and these scholarships when they're in programs that really are educational and the importance, you know, and that correlation between a licensed teacher and that correlation. But then it's the reality of where we are right now, that there's not enough of these providers right now, or not enough of these providers, not enough of these teachers in these programs, child care situations. So can, you know, if you're able to, can you talk globally about, you know, is there other parts of this where we're addressing this need for having more licensed teachers? Because as we're doing it here, we're kind of taking away the stick, I guess. Are there any carrots to replace it with so that there's an incentive for someone to become a licensed teacher?
Thank you, Representative Pryor, for the question. And maybe not quite understanding it. The stick, I suppose, is that the teacher needs to have a license under the specific circumstances described here. And I think that the thinking being that when you're having instruction being provided in a district or charter school based setting, we have instruction in an early education program, that then there's the connection going up that we have a licensure requirement in the other instruction that's happening in that school or that district. And of course, we've talked a lot in our division about how early development and learning, you know, connects right up to the need with learning kind of all the way along. Hopefully that kind of addresses what you're looking for.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, because I appreciate that. And I know that with this amendment, we're dealing with the reality of the situation here rather than the way we would like it to be, because what we would like it is that these are going to child care homes, centers, and all these different arrays where we're talking about scholarships, we're talking about kids being educated, and that ideally someone that's being educated would show that they have that license to provide education. So I support the amendment, but it's just I know that in the larger context it's not the ideal world for what we would like for education, even in the earliest of learners.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any other discussion regarding the A8 amendment? Well, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we hear a lot about the teacher shortage across the state, as well as child care providers, the shortage across the state. And I am just wondering, how does this A8 amendment address the shortages in both fields?
Thank you, Representative Franson. So the amendment itself simply provides a greater tailoring of the language at the bottom of page one, right? So I suppose regarding the amendment itself, what it's doing is taking the language that's in the original, what was now in the amended bill, and providing greater focus for it to make very clear that what we're talking about is situations where the district or school is operating the program and where there's instruction in that program, and then also providing a delayed period of time in which that can be occurring. So regarding the amendment itself, I guess it's maybe not aimed at those particular issues. What it is it's having a more focused approach than what's listed in the bill. So I may be missing. So it's not. I guess it's not quite aimed directly at what you're describing, Representative Franson, because it really is providing a more more tailored version of what's in the bill. And I guess when we get to the bill itself or get to this provision, then maybe it makes sense to discuss that at that point. But either way, okay, sure. And Representative Heitzman, was it? Oh, I'm sorry. Somebody else had something. It is Representative Heitzman. Yes,
thank
please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to piggyback off Representative Pryor's comment, but I think Representative Franson is getting to the heart of what I was specifically concerned about. I think it's fair to say that the amendment does nothing to resolve an issue relative to a shortage, especially in parts of the state like mine, a teacher shortage. And in fact, it exacerbates that problem. It makes it more difficult for people to come into the profession. And the scenario that I would cite is those that maybe they're not sure that this is the career for them, but they're going to look at this as a potential option. And so they don't necessarily come in with the expectation that this is going to be their lifelong pursuit, but this creates another barrier for them to recognize that it could be, Mr. Chair. So I would oppose the amendment.
Okay. Any other discussion regarding the amendment? And hearing none, all in favor of approval of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Okay. So the A8 passes. And then moving on to the A9, I think that's, oh, pardon me, the A7 amendment. A7 amendment. So this relates to the St. Paul College Savings Account proposal. And what the amendment does is describe how the this pilot program can develop into a statewide program. Make sure that I think we're all, I think many, if not all of us, we're really excited by the thought of college savings accounts. We know what the research says, that a small amount early on can make a huge difference for the likelihood that students the children end up going to college and have all kinds of other positive results. And we want to make sure that we can have children and students from around the state being able to take advantage over time. And so this lays out a number of steps for doing that. Discussion on the A7 amendment. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did just want to illuminate here, too, that I spoke a great deal with the bill author and other resources in this, and I think one of the things that we discussed in our previous committee was the idea that we wanted to create something that could be widely used across the state and really be able to use that, including in some of our smaller communities. You know, I think the concern was that Representative Heintzman brought up, and I believe Representative Franzen, that, you know, for smaller communities, some of the setup costs could be really prohibitive for those smaller communities. So we wanted to make sure that with this particular program, that there was a strong focus on being able to do that setup work and sort of create the program and take that setup work out of the way, so that some of those smaller communities then would have a better ability to participate and wouldn't have to incur those types of costs if they choose to join later on. So I think just wanted to illuminate for folks that that is part of what's driving this as well, is making sure that we can make this accessible to folks across the state.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Any other discussion on the A7? Representative Heintzman. No, Franzen, pardon me. Seem to be off today. Representative Franzen.
Let's just say every city wanted to be part of this, and then we'd have to include the townships too. Is there anybody have an idea of how much this would cost the state of Minnesota? Like what we're starting here?
Thanks. So, Representative Franzen, so one thing is I think that one thought is rather than doing it sort of by individual city and township, it may end up making sense to have it be a statewide program, so it wouldn't be, you know, by individual community. And I'm not sure. I think part of the point of the pilot program is to get a sense. I mean, you can see lines 1.7, 1.8, analysis of potential establishment of a statewide program. And so I think we kind of need to have the have it operating in a community, see how it works, and then we can have a better sense as to how that would what the cost would be. I think the hope of the College Savings Account program is that for a really small investment, you actually have a massive payoff, because if you have students who are achieving the post-secondary education, it can actually make a big difference. But I think we kind of have to have this pilot program operating and then see the analysis of that. But, yeah. Other Representative Cotizo-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have the opportunity to speak a little bit further with Mayor Carter about this program, as well as Representative Herr. And just to clarify, one of the questions that I had on the evening hearing that we initially heard about this was specifically about our children across the state in foster care. And so those children who live in St. Paul, who may be relocated by no fault of their own to a family outside of the city of St. Paul, they really took that to heart. It's not something that it had come up initially, and in our further discussion, it kind of came up that foster kids don't always have access to a savings account, a bank account, anything at all. And so this, having this potential for a statewide program, and with the St. Paul pilot, we'd be able to kind of see if it would work out. But this account would follow them through the system, hopefully, you know, ultimately to their adoptive family, but that this would follow them and not stay with a biological family member who they're no longer living with. And I think that for some of the children who are going through adverse childhood experiences, if there is even just a little bit of contribution, that stability for them going forward can make a big, big impact. So I was thrilled that they were willing to discuss that with me. So I would support this amendment.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you also, Representative Cotizo-Witun. Also, to the question, too, which right now I think it would be impossible to say the cost, because one thing about the St. Paul program, and one thing about that's intriguing, I think, for thinking about on a statewide line, possibility is the corporate partnership. I know, like, I think a city that would adapt this next might be Austin, Minnesota, which has the Hormel Foundation. And the foundation is just so much a part of that community. That I can see that they'd be a big partner but then also we'd want to know that it's, if you don't happen to be Austin and you don't have Hormel in your city, we'd want to be able to see how we can pull together all those, that corporate enthusiasm that might be behind it, and to really, because if you think about the report that we're getting from the Chamber of Commerce and those groups, they are talking about the importance of engaging families, and with young children, and getting support to them when they need it most, and putting out there, which this does, this vision of their future as something that we are going to invest in because we care about, because it is our future. So it wouldn't be the state shouldering it alone if it ever became a statewide program. It would be this, you know, we're trying it out as a pilot, and if it does, if it's something that corporations, if private individuals and philanthropists can engage with, you know, we might voluntarily do, then it's something that we could roll out at a statewide level. If it does have that kind of enthusiasm, and if it does kind of catch people's imagination as a way of really supporting families as they, and telling even someone a parent that we care about their newborn too, and that, you know, whether you live in the smallest community in Minnesota or if you live in the densest urban neighborhood, that we believe in Minnesota, we believe in your future, we care about each other.
Thank you, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't go into too much detail because actually Lori covered a part of what I wanted to say, but the other piece of that was talking about additional ways through the pilot to talk about financial literacy and have our children get up to speed on that. And I think one of the things that Lori alluded to was the great idea of how we might be able to leverage this type of a exciting program to put together some of those public and private partnerships. And especially, you know, for some of those smaller areas, you know, we have a lot of, I know in my district, the Osseo is pretty tiny, but they also have a really active Lions Club, for example, who I know would be a perfect example of some folks who would love to help their local communities and things like that. So really grateful for that idea as well. And again, this is a pilot, so we don't know. We want to try it out. But certainly that leads to some opportunities to, even in some of those smaller communities, to do some of that public-private partnering.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Before I call the next person, just a note on decorum, reminder to refer to one another as Representative X as opposed to first names. Want to make sure we preserve decorum. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to oppose your amendment going on, but I do want to kind of reiterate some of the comments that I made previously when we heard the bill. I think that what the bill's trying to do is establish a connection. And I might make the argument that in years past that could have been a grandparent, a neighbor, a friend to a kid. And I think more and more we're trying to put those same good ideas in practice, except we're replacing that grandparent or other connection with the state. And there may be cases where that can work. But I think that more and more we're giving that opportunity, maybe even responsibility, away. And a parent who might, or a grandparent who might say, hey, I'd like to make that connection for this person. Well, the state of Minnesota is now going to do that. And more, we're advocating that responsibility away. That's my concern.
Before I move to Representative Franson, I think wanted to go. I just that's a really interesting point, Representative Heintzman. I think it. I think for a number of us, I think it's maybe a sort of a chicken and egg thought that for a number of us, it's that if many of those ties have frayed, you've still got somebody who's in that position of you know, needs the assistance for college, needs that encouragement, needs that, you know, and so I think we sort of see one basic philosophical difference here, right, in terms of sort of what do you do about it? And I respect your perspective of saying, well, wait a second, if you just step in and do that, you've now caused those ties to fray even more, I think might be one way of putting it. And I think for others of us, we may have a different perspective. But so I appreciate your raising that point. And that's it. Yeah, I'll let you respond if you want to, otherwise I'll go to Representative Franson. Yeah, please.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned friends and others that might be in a kid's life. And there again, though they may not have a direct physical connection to that kid, they may not be blood, but they recognize they may have an opportunity to encourage them. And the same scenario exists. The state is stepping in and saying, we're going to take that responsibility. And I think it's those closest relationships that are going to help kids succeed.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
I don't need to say anything because Representative Heintzman did it for me.
He did it for you. Well spoken, Representative Heintzman. And Representative Bonner, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted one clarification on the point that Representative Heintzman made. Let's keep in mind, this is a savings account. You got to feed it. And the beauty of that is that grandparents, aunts, uncles, godparents, anybody who wants to feed it can certainly do so. There is nothing in this bill that would preclude folks from doing that. And in fact, to be honest, I think we're all hopeful that that's exactly what would happen. So thanks for that.
Thank you. Any final discussion on the A7 amendment? Not seeing any. All in favor of approval of the A7 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So the A7 amendment is adopted. Let's move to the A4 amendment. And I'm not sure who wishes to offer the A4. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to refer to this amendment as the PSEO, the Preschool Enrollment Option Amendment, to help people kind of focus on what I'm looking to accomplish here. I was a PSEO student as a junior and senior, and this amendment requires the Parent Aware Rating System to be applied uniformly to all participating providers and ends the practice of issuing automatic four-star ratings to certain programs like voluntary pre-kindergarten. This treats all participating providers, in my opinion, fairly, and ends this assumption that certain programs are inherently better just because they sign a statement of assurance with no on-site verifications. Second, the amendment empowers a parent to choose the quality program they think is best suited to their kid. That would be the PSEO side of this, in my mind, allows a parent to take those dollars from one location to another if they think it better fits their kid. Parents with a child enrolled in VPK, if they're lucky enough, blessed enough to have that opportunity, can designate another early learning provider that is eligible to receive early learning scholarships. The designated provider would then get 88%, which is exactly the same as my understanding of the PSEO, of the funding allocated to that child, with the remaining 12% staying inside the VPK program for administration and such. This is similar, like I just said, to how we fund PSEO at the junior and senior level. So that's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps this is a question for research, or perhaps we have some experts in the audience who can help us out with this. But I'm curious as to the level of requirements for some of those school-based programs. And it was my understanding that to some degree that those are actually higher level of standards with licensed teachers than currently exist in the parent aware system.
We've got Representative Pryor may even be hopping in to help you with that,
yes.
Representative
Bonner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did, when I saw that amendment, I recalled that we actually had seen the study that showed that the ones that have kind of this accelerated assignment of the four-star rating, there's two things that they do is they, when they're set up, they're actually set up to conform to standards that are even higher than the four-star rating give. So that, let's see, some of it is that it provides comprehensive program content and intentional instructional practice aligned with state early learning standards. And I'm on the K-12 policy. I was last year, and so I know that how important those standards are for our K-12 system. They do assess cognitive and language skills. They involve parents in program planning and decision making. They also are monitored. They have to submit a biennial plan as part of the world's best workforce plan that's received by the Minnesota Department of Education, and that there's oversight of supervision of school readiness programs that are licensed in the early childhood teacher done by the district. So they have all of these criteria, which is actually much beyond the standards that we have for the four stars. And then, but you still, you know, you still want to verify that it works, and that what we expect from these kinds of standards and this process for assessing that they're living up to this high standards, you want to go back and you want to test it to verify it. And so there was actually when they started it, they went back to They did a study to monitor and to make sure that all of the things that we expected to see, we were seeing. And they did the, there was, it was a validation study. It was based on 325 programs and 1,200 children. And so it's been pretty thoroughly vetted, and so I feel confident that it not only does it meet the standards, but it probably exceeds the standards that we do in the four-star rating.
So then, Representative Bonner, I'll go back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I guess with that in mind, I guess I would be concerned about asking us to move to a lesser standard for some of those programs than is currently in existence. I guess I'm not sure the point of asking them to go through that process when they're already exceeding those standards.
Okay, thank you. I've got Representative Cortez Witun next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple of questions for the amendment author. Representative Heintzman, could you clarify, so this is for children who have enrolled in the voluntary pre-K program in lieu of applying for a separate scholarship. Is that correct?
Representative Heintzman.
This is for kids that are funded through the VPK program, and they may be in a situation where their parent says, I'd like to be able to utilize this particular opportunity as opposed to this four-star aware program, which for some folks may be great. Maybe that's the very best option for their kids. And, you know, the testimony a moment ago from Representative Pryor and Representative Bonner, I agree. There may be great opportunities for those kids, and there's been some opportunities to verify the outcomes. But at the same time, why aren't we trusting parents to make those choices for their own kids? Why not give them flexibility? Years ago, when the opportunity for students in the K through 12 system at junior and senior level were allowed to make a change and get some dual credit, that meant immense opposition. But guess what? People loved it. They loved that they could give their kids an opportunity that they otherwise didn't have in the K through 12 system. And kids are utilizing it across the state of Minnesota very effectively in most cases. So I'd prefer to give parents the opportunity to be empowered to make those choices for their kids.
Representative Cadiz Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that, Representative Heintzman. Excuse me. I'm sort of confused why the parents would choose to enroll their children in VPK instead of just applying for a scholarship if their intention is to go through a provider that has is able to accept scholarships.
If that's a question.
I don't know if you
sure, Representative Heintzman,
comment.
Yeah.
I could comment again.
Yep. Representative Heintzman. Well, it seemed to be sent over your way. So go for it.
I think it's more of a comment, but I'll just point out again. I think that if a parent may have received this opportunity in VPK and later on is looking at their situation and saying, "Huh, I didn't realize that I had this school that might better fit my kid's needs," why not give them that flexibility? Give that parent an opportunity to choose for their kid how they want those dollars allocated going forward, and it keeps 12% in the VPAK program so they can act as a fiscal agent, and then the remaining dollars they have to use in a way that they think best fits their kids' needs.
I do want to note that the comparison to PSCO seems to me not an entirely apt one, and in that case, there is a transition happening to post-secondary and the need for the dual credits to then, make it cheaper and quicker and all that. Whereas in this case, the child is transitioning into school. It seems like this is sort of going the opposite direction in a way. You want to get that kid going on post-secondary at the end. I understand where you're coming from, Representative Heintzman, but it does feel like it's not quite the right comparison, but we'll keep on going, and then we can, and obviously we'll give you the last word on your own amendment. Representative Cortez Witun.
Thank you. And then my second question would be, if we are going to go ahead and streamline or apply the uniform rating process so that all programs have to be equally assessed on site, as you mentioned, do we have any idea how much of a fiscal cost to the state and to the taxpayers that would be if we have to hire additional assessors? What type of timeline that would be looking like if we have to go into centers that already are pre-approved because they apply to a higher assessment process and what that would look like? How much would we be looking at for that?
Representative Heintzman.
I'm thrilled that we may be actually considering supporting this and allowing it to move forward, and I can have a fiscal note created very easily if we are going to be debating this on the House floor.
Thank you.
I'd also call for a roll call, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay, roll call has been requested. There'll be a roll call. Representative Cotiz-Witun, looks like, hold on, okay. Representative Pryor, you were next on the list. You had a chance to talk earlier, but you may be done. Wasn't sure. Okay. All done. Okay. We'll go to Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question, Representative Pryor, in that validation study, how many voluntary preschool programs were included?
Representative Pryor. Looks like she's looking it up. We can do another. Yeah, we can go to another. She can get back to us later. Okay, good.
Yep.
Okay, good. All right, Representative. Anything else right now? No.
Nope.
Enough. Okay. Representative Heintzman, I had you on the list. We can have you go now, or we can have you go if you want to say something now. Or we can. But we're also going to give you the last word as well, Representative
Heintzman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sure. I'll be very brief. I just appreciate you letting me bring this amendment forward and the lively debate. Thank you for that, and I hope that we can. Move it through the process, and I can have a fiscal note for Representative Cotiz-Witun. That'd be great.
That's good. You'll push it out. Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heintzman, I'm wondering if you can, in the letter C in this amendment, it says the school district or charter school must continue to count the eligible child in its enrollment for the rest of the school year. I'm wondering if you can just clarify why that's there or the purpose. I'm just curious about that.
Representative Heintzman.
So I thought we were did I have a last word, or we're going back into questions, Mr. Chair?
Oh, I'm sorry. What I meant was you were on my list as the next person to talk, and there were several people after you, and so I was just going to you in that way. Sorry. We're still in the middle of debate. And my apologies if I was unclear on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sure. So I'm assuming that's so they can set their percentage of funds available. So that's my understanding.
Anything else? Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate that I'm a little leery about the idea of suggesting that someone who's in a pre-K program that has a much higher standard would want the flexibility to move their child into a program with less rigor and less quality. I'm really concerned about what that's saying or the purpose or the intent of that. And I have to be frank with you, for that reason, I have to be candid. I do not support this amendment.
So anyone else before we give Representative Franson? Yes.
I'm just going to say, Representative Bonner, the VPK program is an honor-based system, so they attest to their standards, whereas Parent Aware is on a different rating level. So I could be running a school-based government program and say, yep, I'm got all these standards, and then I'm given, my rating. Here I am, super high quality, right? And that's just because I say so. Nobody's really verifying it.
I think it's the same, and it's part of a school district, right? So we have our schools, really all of our public school programming is we've got the various standards. We've got whole, committees on education policy, et cetera, making sure that there are standards that are being met. And so I guess my thinking is this is part of that process. Anyone else before we give Representative Heintzman the last word? I would urge members to oppose the amendment, and I appreciate the thoughtfulness, the thought that's gone into it. But it seems to me that we have quite high standards for our public school programming, including the VPK programming, and it makes sense, consistent with that. As we heard, even the testimony several weeks ago, when this was discussed a bit, that there would be a process that we wouldn't have to have those programs then go through all those extra steps, because in fact they're going through a whole another set of steps. And I do think the comparison with PSEO, as I said, is really not an apt one. I think it's a pretty different setup, and we have a number of programs right now that meet different families' needs in different circumstances, and that certainly includes VPK. So I would urge members to vote against, but I will give Representative Heintzman the final word before we vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for those watching at home, I'm just going to reiterate what I think is a very critical part of this discussion, and that is that this amendment ends this idea, this what I consider to be unfair system of simply providing a rating based on what I would argue is not verifiable information. It ends the assumption that certain programs are inherently better just because they sign a statement of assurance. There is no on-site verification. Yes, program is in a school. That gives you some idea that this program is going to meet a requirement. But to be very clear, a parent may find that a non-accredited system inside of another institution could technically have more rigor, but maybe they don't necessarily have the stars next to their name proving that. This gives parents that opportunity to make that choice for their child.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. And so with that, we'll have the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair?
No.
Representative Katizo-Attun, Vice Chair?
No.
Representative Franson?
No. Oh, yes. Yes, sorry.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Damath?
Yes.
Representative Heintzman?
Yes.
Representative Morrison?
No.
Representative Pryor?
No.
Representative Wasilek?
No.
Representative West?
Yes.
And there being a vote of 4 in favor and 6 against, the amendment is not adopted. And moving on to the A5 amendment, who is offering that? Representative West, I think. Yes? Okay.
Unprecedented, and I don't.
All right.
I'd like to move the A5 amendment. This amendment fully funds the early learning scholarship programs for eligible children from birth to 5. And it sets a scholarship amount at an amount greater of the to either 25th percentile of the most recent care provider survey or the statewide general education revenue per pupil, whichever one's greater. And it expands the eligibility providers to include eligible care assistant program provider rate differential. And in my view, early learning scholarships are the way to go for giving parents the option to send their kids wherever they want. They might not prefer the school-run programs in their area. I mean, I have one up in my area, and I've talked to a lot of care providers that are concerned they're not going to have the enrollment to have a competitive rate for their infants. And it's put them in a really tough situation, and if we can fully fund this early learning scholarship program, it'll help the care providers still exist because we all know, especially in rural Minnesota, but even in my suburban area, they're having a hard time staying in business, even though like my brother with 3 kids pays $2,500 a month, and it's pretty outrageous. So you got to be making $80,000 a year for it to be worth leaving your home and not staying home taking care of the kids. So I'd greatly appreciate the support of this amendment because we need to make sure our early learning scholarships are available to everyone who wants them, so everybody has the opportunity to send their kids to, you know, care provider.
Thank you, Representative West. Representative Wasilek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative West, I'm wondering if you have any idea how much this would cost if we were to implement this.
Representative West.
Well, it expands the eligibility, so we don't have a very hard cost, but it'll be the potential cost would be about $280 million a year.
Okay. Question maybe for House Research is just to explain to folks that line 1.18, the reference to the provider rate differential. What's the implication of that? If somebody can assist us with that, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, members, so that reference is to a rate differential that's available to providers under the CCAP program, and the availability is based on various types of degrees and accreditation certifications and so forth that different types of CCAP providers have. So this would have the effect of broadening the programs that would be able to accept scholarship students or children.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Burris. I'll just say, Representative West, I'm thrilled by the general commitment and vision to say that we want to get that we want to be supporting early care and learning. And this is a and I think we're going to be discussing House File 1 in a form in an upcoming amendment. So we'll be eager to be talking about that. And I think that vision is terrific. I think that there's a number of different pieces, and again, we're going to talk about that shortly, but certainly including scholarships for really young kids. I guess if this is part of a longer-term commitment to that, I think that sounds terrific. I'll say at this point of where we're at in the session, as we're putting our division reports up for the committees above us, et cetera, I'm going to urge members to vote against this. Because we need to be fitting in. We need to make sure that what we're sending up is then fitting in with each of the higher bills above us. But I got to tell you, the general point, we want to make sure that we get kids off to a great start, including scholarships as part of that. I certainly would support. I'd say the only part of it. I think there's a number of other pieces as well. So maybe that'd be another element where I would urge members to vote against this as well, as it feels like it's sort of one piece and does include some of the other pieces that we need as well. And again, we'll probably talk about that in the upcoming amendment. So thank you for bringing it forward. I'd urge members to vote against, but I appreciate it. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly appreciate the intent here to expand access for scholarships and actually think that's fantastic. But I am a little bit concerned, and I was wondering if our fiscal staff could help with a question.
I think that they're willing to.
Okay. Representative West mentioned that he thought that the cost for this would be somewhere around roughly $2 million.
I think he said 280. $280 million? $280 million.
$280 million?
I'm
sorry.
Okay. $2 million would be good. That'd be great.
Okay. Well, $280 million. Okay. But even at $280 million, with expanding that for the additional 2 years, and based on what we've been hearing previously in testimony, that feels really low. Could you maybe speak to if that's in the right ballpark? Do we think it's considerably more? Is it on par with what you would expect?
Ms. Adrians.
Mr. Chair and members, I would need to request a fiscal note to feel really confident, but I do think, if this type of language were to be implemented, you could potentially reduce spending on other programs that service the same population. So even if you had 100% participation at all age levels for them, then, so that would be quite expensive, but then you could potentially reduce spending in other areas. So, it is hard to say, but I think upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars is probably an appropriate amount. But we would really need to speak with the agencies to get a very accurate number.
Representative Bonner.
When you say hundreds of millions of dollars, we're already talking about hundreds of millions of dollars.
I think she said upwards of hundreds of millions
right.
of dollars as well.
So I guess I'm wondering, do we think it could be significantly more than that?
I think you may have trouble getting more than Ms. Adrian said out of her Representative Bonner. Yeah, I think that's kind of as far as she can take it. And noting, as I said before, too, that it's one leg of a stool. I think it's really important to have the connection with school that's represented, in my view, represented by pre-kindergarten programming through districts, recognizing the benefit of childcare assistance in a number of situations. And again, we'll get to where scholarships may not apply. So I just feel like, but the general commitment to the idea that we want to get kids off to a great start and a willingness to invest significant resources doing that, I very much appreciate it. Representative Bonner has another follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I really appreciate this, and I really think that there could be some good merit into exploring this, I guess at least at this time, without having a really good idea of what that fiscal cost is, particularly considering our current budget situation, I guess I would be leery about accepting this amendment without having a better understanding of the financial cost.
Okay, Representative Bonner. So we'll give Representative West the last word here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to request a roll call.
And roll call has been requested. There will be one.
And I do appreciate that in your bill you do extend it from birth. You know, I think that's important because infant care is really what's going to crazy expensive for parents. I mean, it's and for care providers with the ratios they have, it's crazy expensive for them too. So I mean, when you say this is only one leg of the stool, it's like I think this is the most important leg of the stool because it gives parents the most choice in what they want their kids to be taught. Or really, we're talking about daycare as in just keeping their kids alive, making sure it takes place in a school atmosphere or something like that. It's we want to make sure that parents have the ability to send them wherever they will. And I do appreciate what this early learning scholarship part that's already existing in the bill. And with some of the targets we've seen for the committees, I think there is a lot of room to fit this in there. So I'd appreciate further consideration if it doesn't happen to make it on today. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative West. So with that, we'll have the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Katizawatun, Vice Chair.
No.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Damath.
Yes.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
No.
Representative Pryor.
No.
Representative Wasilek.
No.
Representative West.
Yes.
And there being a vote of 4 in favor and 6 against, the amendment does not pass. Is not adopted. And now the DE4 amendment, and who is offering that? Representative Franson.
That'd be me.
Okay.
So this is probably looking very familiar. This is your House File 1. Mm-hmm. Your most important bill that you've introduced, because it's number one.
Mm-hmm.
So as introduced, to provide additional resources focusing on prenatal care and children ages 0 to 3, this amendment provides additional resources focusing on prenatal care and the children ages 0 to 3. The primary strategies employed by this amendment include greater emphasis on prenatal care, home visitation for pregnant and families with young children, expanded early learning and child care programs with more funding for children ages 0 to 3. Additionally, it maintains the current enrollment cap for voluntary pre-K school readiness plus and provides $10 million in economic development grants for child care providers. So I thought this would be appropriate so that you guys could all vote on your number one priority.
Thank you, Representative Franson.
You're welcome.
And I'm delighted we get a chance to talk about this because there's really good stuff. But anyways, we'll get to that. Anybody wants to start? I guess I'll begin, and we'll see if anybody wants to jump in. So I'm delighted to have this be raised. And I will note my excitement that actually in these two bills, but in other places as well, we actually have a replication of the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act in each of the different pieces. Now, of course, we're at a point in the session where things are different level, et cetera. We'll talk about that. And it's Representative Katizawatun is the author of this bill, and I'm so grateful for that because it is important that we view early childhood issues from a broad perspective and think from birth up. So the reference to prenatal care, Representative Franson and members. So prenatal care, as it turns out, is not in the jurisdiction of this committee, but I'm delighted to let you know that provisions related to prenatal care, including this, authored by Representative Morrison, are in fact moving along. I'm looking at Representative Morrison and seeing her nod. In fact, moving along in the Health and Human Services policy and then moving to Health and Human Services Finance Division, along with some related provisions relating to breastfeeding and other points about making sure that we have our babies and our moms get off to a great start at the very beginning. Delighted to let you know as well that there is both some new home visiting money in our division report, and then also language that allows home visiting services to go to home visiting funds to go to evidence-informed providers. Also delighted to let you know that there's been a tripling of funding for home visiting in this biennium, and we're protecting that base funding. I think there's bipartisan support, bicameral support, recognizing that's an incredible program. And again, we are protecting that, in fact, enhancing it, expanding it. House File 1 does, as was noted by Representative Franson, has a focus on birth to three. And just to step back for 1 second, we've had comments about the number of briefings that we've received in this division. And House File 1 and then these division reports, to my mind, are really connected to the briefings that we've received. So Dr. Megan Gunner on our very first day talked about the importance of brain development in the earliest years. That has been, and recognizing that by age three, 85%, 90% of the brain synapses have been grown and are all set. The brain has been formed. And then we heard from Professor Aaron Sojourner, who talked about the experiences of Representative West, not by name, of course, but Representative West's family. The experience, he said, $2,500 a month and how crazy expensive it is. It's extremely challenging for families to be dealing with childcare costs. So we have these two crises going on, one in childcare and for families, and then the other one in opportunity gaps that we're experiencing throughout our state. So what House File 1 does and what these bills do is to have a great expansion of CCAP and of scholarships aimed at those earliest years, and certainly we have that. And then finally, the child care provider grants are both moving in other divisions, and then in our division as well, through First Children's Finance and the retained grants, we're funding that as well. So we're at a point in the session, where we're obviously at a different level than when this is introduced, but the idea, but the themes that have been set and the vision that's been set by Representative Katisa Witun, we are seeing in these our division reports, and we're going to continue seeing along the way. So I'm so glad to have the opportunity to talk about this, and it's important we have a holistic vision, and I certainly think that we're continuing to. So we've got a few people on the list. Representative Wozlik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think, as we referenced, this is like House File 1, essentially, in just an amendment form. And so I'm curious, if we're offering this as an amendment, why folks on the committee on the other side didn't sign on to House File 1 if they support this. I'm just confused about why that didn't happen.
Representative Franson.
Oh, I'm just presenting an opportunity for you to vote on the original bill as introduced.
I'm not, okay. Others. Okay. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am delighted to see that Representative Franzen is in full support of the vision that was laid out in House File 1, and that while she did not feel the need to vote on it earlier or to sign on, that she is now fully on board with all of the mission that was set out within that file.
That may or may not be true. We'll be hearing from Representative Franzen. Representative Morrison.
Old freshman.
That's Representative Morrison.
I just wrote down a couple of things, so thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Bear with me if I read them.
Yeah, please.
I'm so proud of where we are as a committee. I wanted to be on this committee because there's so much research that supports the importance of the first years of children's lives in terms of setting them up to thrive for the rest of their lives. As a physician, I'm a big fan of data and research and science, and as an obstetrician, I have the honor of being the first to hold some of our brand new Minnesotans. It's a profound moment to see that brand new life and look into that baby's eyes and wonder what's ahead, and to share that moment of hope and big dreams with the baby's parents. I'm incredibly proud of the big vision and goals that House File 1 set, and I'm honored to be a part of the beginning of that conversation. As our Republican colleagues well know, we all know, resources are limited and we can't do everything that we want to do. I'm thrilled that we've started this conversation. I'm proud to be shepherding the two bills that Chair Pinto referenced that have broad bipartisan support and that will work to address the disparities that exist in our state. We all win when our newest Minnesotans get off to the best possible start.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Representative Katisa Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Franzen, for bringing this amendment. I'm excited to see the original language of the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act as a possible amendment here today. But we all know that every day, all of us as individuals, as well as every piece of legislation that we bring to the table, is a work in progress. So I think that the original bill, HF1, is full up, but if anyone even want to clone it and bring it on, I'd be glad for the support. HF1 is a bold set of investments to support our youngest Minnesotans and their families. We have had the opportunity, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving us the opportunity so far this session to hear about how important and informative the first few years of life are, prenatal to pre-K. They truly impact the rest of a child's life. In the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act, we highlighted some critical initiatives to stem the achievement gap here in Minnesota by addressing maternal and infant mortality rates, home visiting opportunities, investing in both scholarships and child care assistance to help families cover the cost of child care, and supporting child care providers by increasing rates and providing grants for potential improvements in delivery. As a new mother to three young children, I empathize with the families across the state trying to find quality, affordable child care. I know firsthand what it's like to spend almost twice a mortgage payment in child care costs and to try to figure out whether to take unpaid time away from work to care for your children or to spend much, if not all, of a paycheck on child care. I had to decide that just this last summer. These are the tough choices that parents in Minnesota are dealing with on a daily basis. I'm grateful for the testifiers who have shared their stories about the positive impact that scholarships and CCAP have had on their lives. We had the fortune to hold a field hearing up in St. Cloud and learn firsthand some of the struggles facing families, providers, and community partners in greater Minnesota. We've also learned that these struggles are not unique to us here in the state of Minnesota. And in fact, we see comparable rates and declining availability in Wisconsin, perhaps with an extremely different regulatory climate than we have here. I value the insight of providers who have shared the challenges that they have in providing high-quality delivery with some low reimbursement rates. I appreciate and acknowledge the expertise of our medical and community development professionals who've shared the data showing that these investments have a measurable impact on outcomes. On Tuesday night, we heard from the advocates across the early childhood spectrum who support the various sections of this division report. It's clearer now more than ever to me that while no one piece of this amendment can get us to where we want to go, when we work together and provide support for families when and where they need it most, we can accomplish wonderful things. With the introduction of the Great Start for All Minnesota Children Act, I had hoped to set a high bar for the steps that we must take in order to fulfill our commitment to each Minnesota child, that they may reach their true potential. And I think that we accomplished that. Every child deserves a great start to life here in Minnesota, and we all benefit when that happens. I'm proud that our division reports include the various parts of HF1 in miniature with some additional improvements. And I know that while we have a long way to go, that this package is also a great start. Thank you for bringing this amendment. But given the current realities in generating revenue statewide to make the funding for every piece of HF1 possible immediately, members, I will encourage a no vote today. And I will ask that you work with me as we strive to achieve the goals detailed within the Great Start Act. Thank you.
Representative Kuzin-Zubatun, thank you for setting out the vision in HF1. And it feels like we're, as you say, our division reports are a great start on the Great Start Act. So thank you. We'll give Representative Franzen the final word.
Oh, just roll call.
Okay. They have a roll call. I've been requested. There will be one. We'll have the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Kuzin-Zubatun, Vice Chair.
No.
Representative Franzen. No. Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Damuth.
No.
Representative Heintzman.
No.
Representative Morrison.
No.
Representative Pryor.
No.
Representative Wasilek.
No.
Representative West.
There being zero votes in favor, 10 votes against, the motion does not pass. The amendment is not adopted. Representative Franzen, thank you also for giving us an opportunity to all come together on a vote. I believe that's it in terms of amendments, unless I'm missing something. And so we now move to discussion on House File 2610 as a whole. Any discussion on that? And members, Representative Franzen, yes, no? Oh, I'm not seeing that, okay. Members, I really appreciate the thoughtful debate and discussion we had on the amendments and leading into the bill. She does have one, okay. You're the only one on the list at the moment, so you certainly can. Oh, that's fine. No, I was going because I didn't think anybody else was. Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah, go for it. Representative Franzen.
So,
very riveting things I've got to say here.
Yeah, go for it.
Mr. Chair, House File 2610 as amended here is a missed opportunity for this division. Despite the number one goal, House File 1, including a significant increase in the number of early learning scholarships, this bill provides only a modest increase in the early scholarship funding while providing no reforms to the parent aware system, which we heard time and time again from the providers who were able to show up and testify on how unfair that system is, or expanding access to more qualified providers. And the repeal of the cap on the so-called Pathway 2 scholarships means pumping more money into programs rather than funding increased capacity to serve more families. And this bill undermines the current program in cutting off funding for four-year-olds and shifts that funding to children birth through three, clearly setting up an expectation that future expansion of the voluntary pre-kindergarten program will fill that gap and drive more family child care providers out of the system. As I have spoken time and time again in this committee, the government programs are competing with the private industry, and private industry cannot keep up with that competition, and we have a crisis on our hands with our child care providers, and this is contributing to that cause. The extending funding for voluntary pre-K does not include any language to prohibit programs from simply supplanting existing funding with new state aid, thus limiting any real hope of expanding capacity to actually serve more kids. And our priority should be empowering parents and serving more children. I believe that parents are the best determinant of where quality is and where they should send their children. And this bill falls well short of this priority. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will be voting on this no on this bill, and I encourage you all to do the same. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Franson. Members, thank you again for the thoughtful discussion on House File 2610 as amended. I think that I want to highlight for members, because I don't know that we really had done this before, how this fits into that, into the broader vision, even in some more detailed ways, recognizing that we have this exciting program. We talked about it earlier with the college savings accounts. As an opportunity to get kids off to a great start. It's my hope that that ends up spreading statewide. There's incredible research on that. The Reach Out and Read appropriation, and there's been incredible research on that as well and the impact on that, et cetera. What we've done here is make sure that that we're providing additional support for scholarships, and I'm so glad to have had that amendment before, but also making sure that we don't lose any voluntary pre-K slots. That is a powerful program. I want to challenge the idea that that in fact there is any supplanting of funding going on or that there's any reduction in quality going on. In fact, if anything, that's to my mind a critical program in connecting our kids, our youngest kids with school as well. So this, to my mind, this is a terrific division report that we'll be able to hand off to our colleagues in education finance. It certainly doesn't go, each of our pieces doesn't go as far as I would like as somebody who's been working on early childhood issues for years and years. But it is, as we discussed before, this is a great start and a next step. And so with that, I'd urge members to support the amended House File 2610. So all in favor of adoption of passage of House File 2610 as amended, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Okay. And with that, House File 2610 is passed to, pardon? Is referred, thank you, is referred to the Education Finance Division. So moving on then to House File 1801. Pull that up. And so we're going to start with the A8. So this was amended the other day, but then for today we're going to start with the A8 amendment. And this is my amendment makes a few, adds a few points. And I think what I'll probably do is maybe just ask if there is discussion on the A8 amendment, and then we can go from there. Any discussion on the A8 amendment? Okay, not hearing any. All in favor of adoption of the A8, the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. The A8 amendment is adopted. Thank you, members. Okay. And then let's move to the A11. And who is offering the A11? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this amendment redirects all the increased spending for the CCAP program to fund the increase for children under the age of 6 supported through the North Star Care for Children program. This division passed HF 1653 but provided no funding for the increase. We all heard powerful testimony, and I'm sure we all agree with the importance of this program in serving some of our most vulnerable children. We don't know the full extent of the fraud within the child care assistance program, but we do know that the North Star Care for Children program is important for thousands of children and these families. So generously providing them a safe home could certainly use the help. So, Mr. Chair, I hope that we can vote this amendment on, and I appreciate some comment and discussion.
Discussion to the A11 amendment. Representative Cadiza-Witoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. I agree with you wholeheartedly that the North Star Care for Children program could use some additional funding. This is something that affects my family personally, so I'm going to be abstaining from a vote on this amendment. But I think that it's really important. I think that there is such an amalgam of opportunity and choices for families, for providers to get reimbursed for the care that they're providing to children. And I guess my concern with this amendment is that I think taking away any increase in the CCAP funding may have kind of an adverse effect, perhaps an unintended consequence, in that some of these North Star children may qualify for CCAP. So I just want to make sure that for the families who don't have access to funding through this adoptive program and foster care process, that they're not losing out on some of that funding. So I think that I would encourage a no vote on this amendment simply because I think that we need to have all these programs together and so that we need to find funding for everything. But I know that that's difficult. So I appreciate you bringing it forward. I'm going to abstain, but thank you very much.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
I really appreciate those comments, although I do think that the amendment deserves a yes vote. And I think the reason for that is because the CCAP program, I believe, has the money. And the money is there, except unfortunately, there's fraud in the program. We know that. And I think this is a program that I'm trying to fund in this amendment. It might affect your family very positively, but also affect a lot of others. And we know that this program is functioning at a high level. And I think it's more deserving, quite honestly, in the sense that it's working, whereas we see some major problems in the CCAP program. And until those problems are resolved, I really have some serious reservations as to why we're increasing funding inside what we know to be a program with some serious problems. That'd be my response.
And Representative Heintzman, in your comments earlier, you talked about sort of the front page of this amendment, but can you talk about the back page, please, the deletion of these sections? Well, what is the purpose of that, Representative Heintzman?
Could House Research go through that a little bit? There are some question marks, I suppose, that some people may have.
So maybe just if we could understand what Representative Heintzman is proposing to do on the page 2 of the A11 amendment. I have some ideas of it, but let's get it nailed down first.
Mr. Chair, members, in a nutshell, it would eliminate a number of CCAP federal conformity provisions that have costs associated with them. So you see adjusted amounts on the first page. And so in order to shift funds from what is under the delete all amendment going towards CCAP, both the CCAP program increase and some and as well as the basic sliding fee, those would be eliminated and those dollars would go towards North Star Care for Children. And then the provisions that carry costs are in a number of the sections on CCAP federal conformity. And that's what's being removed in the various sections on page 2 of the amendment.
So as I understand it, our state is required to conform to there's a number of requirements from the feds for the funding that's being provided to CCAP. We were supposed to have implemented them several years ago. We didn't comply. We received extension, et cetera. And the provisions being deleted here would have us comply. Or the provisions would have us comply, and deleting them would mean that we would remain out of federal compliance. Am I saying that right, Mr. Bruce?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, I think that's a fair description.
Okay. And among the provisions being deleted here are provisions that would, I mean, setting aside, so, and we would then lose federal funding if we remain out of compliance. Am I right about that, Mr. Bruce?
Mr. Chair and members, the department might be able to speak to it further, but that would be a risk. And okay. The department, I think, had indicated some likelihood or possibility of potential loss of federal funds, I think, coming this fall. But they would be able to get into the specifics of how much or how likely.
Okay. I'll have a few more things, but I want to Representative Heinzman wants to step in here, so I'll let him do that.
I do, because okay, I think please. Mr. Burris said that very well, okay. That it's a risk. And the truth is we don't know what the federal government is going to do. We hear similar threats in education with Title I funding. What we do know is that the state funding needed to meet federal minimum requirements can and should be recovered from the wasteful and sometimes criminal child care fraud. This division report will go to HHS Finance, and I think they can address further if necessary. But we have a chance to send a strong signal to HHS, the HHS Finance Division, that we believe that the North Star Care for Children adjustment should be funded and given priority. And so I just think, Mr. Chair, that while there may be a concern, and I think it's very good to have a discussion relative to that, we really do not know what the federal government is going to do on this. We do know that this North Star Care for Children adjustment is a super positive way to be using these resources in a program that will benefit lots of families. And I think that you can make a strong argument they're doing the Lord's work. So I think that makes good sense to put the investment there as opposed to a program that we know is still being plagued by fraud and waste.
And Representative Heinzman, I mean, besides just the federal conformity issue, there's also the actual underlying changes relating to that. So I'm looking on page 13, for example. You're proposing to delete Section 9, which provides assistance for families who are homeless. And there are a number of other pieces relating to that as well in terms of allowing families to transition between programs. I'm looking at Section 11, allowing for a fair hearing for applicants and recipients. These are things required under federal conformity. They're also just good things. So I guess I'm wondering what why we wouldn't have some of these provisions that are assisting families as well. I guess I have concerns on multiple levels, just relating to that piece of the removal of these sections. I'll end with a couple folks. Well, obviously, if you have the last word in your own amendment. Representative Wozelik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you addressed a few of the things that I had concerns with, particularly with homeless families. I work in school-based childcare, and we had a family that was homeless living in a shelter, I believe in St. Paul. And I imagine for them, these provisions would have been pretty helpful. But I also think the things that were, as you said, the things that were this amendment is looking to delete are also things like fair hearings for providers and appeals for providers. And I think we're really trying to help homeless families and families on MFIP and really vulnerable folks in our population, as well as providers with some of these changes that we're making. I also have concern because we're hearing across Minnesota, both metro and rural Minnesota, that childcare access is a huge concern. In fact, one of the top concerns that business groups, for example, are saying that their employees and folks in the communities are having trouble getting access to childcare. And I think it's really important that we continue to fund CCAP and do what we can to make sure that folks in metro rural Minnesota have these funds available so that they can access childcare and really make sure that they're able to have their kids in childcare and in quality programs as well. So I would urge a no vote on this amendment because I think it is really harmful to those populations that homeless families, for example, MFIP families, but also to kind of the goals of a lot of folks across the state, which is that we're trying to increase access to childcare. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wazlewick. Before I turn things back to Representative Heintzman, who will get the last word, I guess I was maybe somebody else have. Well, Representative Heintzman. And we'll be talking further, I know, before we have a final vote on the division report about on the importance of CCAP, because in my view, we absolutely need to continue funding it and to fund it at a I'll say part of the integrity of the program is making sure the program is actually funded. And as we know, there's been some massive gaps. And so we'll get to that as we continue the discussion. And we've had a really genial conversation in general along the way. But I guess this, I will admit that this amendment in particular really frustrates me because I feel like it's putting kids and families who are languishing on the CCAP waiting list and are in desperate need of child care assistance, putting them up against kids who are in foster care, who are in need of adoption, and I don't feel that that's an appropriate trade-off. It's not a trade-off that I'm willing to make. I'll point out that the particular bill that was referenced, North Star Care for Children account, is in the HHS finance area. We sent that on up, and obviously we're very supportive. I'm very supportive of that account, but the thought that we would be taking child care assistance away from families under these circumstances and in a situation where we're going to be putting ourselves at even greater risk of losing federal support. And when you look at the specific elements that would be deleted are things that are actually helpful and good. I will admit this amendment in particular I find quite aggravating, and I will be very glad to vote against it. But having said that, Representative Heisman, we'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be clear, Mr. Chair, what this bill does is it redirects increased spending in the CCAP program at a time when folks are quite vocal about their feelings about the CCAP program, Mr. Chair. In fact, there are those calling for it to be completely defunded. This committee has an opportunity to say, wait a minute, before we put more money into CCAP, why don't we look to try to find other ways to spend those dollars in a way that's, I think, more responsible? And so I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, that you feel the way that you do about this particular bill, but there's folks that have, I think, stronger feelings relative to the fraud that's taking place in the program. And so this gives Democrats and Republicans an opportunity to come together and say, no, we think that's wrong. And so that's why I'm bringing the amendment.
Okay.
I'd like to ask for a roll call, please, Mr. Chair.
A roll call has been requested. There will be one. We'll have the clerk take the roll on the A11 amendment.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Katiza Watun, Vice Chair.
I abstain.
Representative Franson. Yes. Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Dameth.
Yes.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
No.
Representative Pryor.
No.
Representative Wazlik.
No.
Representative West.
There being three in favor and five against, with one abstention, the motion fails and the amendment is not adopted. So the A10 amendment, who is offering that?
I'll be offering that.
Representative Dameth.
Yep. The A10 amendment, this amendment redirects the funding allocated for CCAP to reduce the current basic sliding fee waiting list to the Minnesota Department of Education to use those same funds to provide early learning scholarships prioritized to those same families. For purposes of this appropriation, the eligibility for early learning scholarships is expanded to serve children from birth to five. Until we can be more assured that the funding for CCAP is not being wasted or stolen through fraud, we should be allocating these funds to other early learning programs, such as the Early Learning Scholarship Program.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Damuth. Comments? I guess I'll make one, and I'm waiting to see if anybody else wants to. So as I've said before, I really value the Early Learning Scholarship Program. In my view, it has a great role to play, and we should be increasing funding for it. In fact, we're proposing to do that both in this bill and have along the way. I also love the Voluntary Pre-Kindergarten Program and think it has an incredible role to play, and I'm proud to be keeping slots and would love to continue to expand. And I absolutely think that the CCAP program, I know the CCAP program has a really important role to play and is deserving of increased funding as well. And what I want to point out, just in comparison between these two programs, and this is what the amendment does, is that CCAP allows for flexible hours and longer hours, overnight, if you've got somebody who's working an overnight shift. There's different eligibility requirements, there's, of course, a cap that's currently imposed on scholarships. Many of us would love to have that lifted, et cetera. When I work with advocates, what I hear from folks is that each of these programs has a role, and that CCAP absolutely has an irreplaceable role for kids and families. Right now, we have kids and families on the wait list, and families that are using the CCAP program are using it to move out of poverty, the steps from MFIP and MFIP transition and basic sliding fee. I would love to have these programs be better coordinated, and our division reports include the proposal for that. That might have actually been in the last report. I wish I'd highlighted. Maybe it's in this one. But to have CCAP and early learning scholarships, have the departments propose how to have them be better coordinated. But having said that, the idea that we would be diverting funding that is dedicated, and literally says this in the amendment, from the program waiting list to this other program, to my mind, is not the appropriate way to go, and would not be in the best interest of kids and families, which should be our top area of focus. And so I would urge members to oppose the amendment. Anyone else before we go back to Representative Damuth for the last word? Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would just say that when human beings are involved, we make mistakes. Bad things sometimes happen. Fraud happens, and we should definitely do everything that we can to eliminate that. But fraud happens in private health insurance. Fraud happens in all areas of life. And so I think that we don't, for lack of a better analogy, want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And CCAP has a very important role. And so I would urge a no on this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Morrison, and thanks for highlighting that. We'll get to that when we get to the bill. But of course, there's much in this in our division report that addresses the integrity of the CCAP program and recognizes, as you say, that we want to make sure that the kids and families that have been on the wait list are not hurt by our response. To make sure that we want to recognize that they're the people who are hurt the most by having funds not go to the intended purpose, and we don't want to have them be hurt further by failing to invest in the program, even as we are ensuring the integrity of the program evermore. Anyone else before we turn back to Representative Damuth? So to the amendment's author, Representative Damuth, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would request a roll call on this amendment, please.
Okay. Roll call having been requested, there will be one. And with that, we'll have the clerk take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Katiza Watoon, Vice Chair.
No.
Representative Franson?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
No.
Representative Damuth?
Yes.
Representative Heintzman?
Yes.
Representative Morrison?
No.
Representative Pryor?
No.
Representative Wasilek?
No.
Representative West?
There being 3 in favor and 6 against, the motion fails. The amendment is not adopted. Members, I think it looks like we're going to need to come back regardless. I know folks have things to address. We have one more, I think just one more amendment. Okay, good. I'm seeing nods. And then discussion on the bill. I'm hopeful the floor debate won't be too long, but I'm inclined rather than pushing through on these right now. I think what I want to do is recess. We'll come back after the session, recognizing these are the only two orders of items of business, and then do that. And rather than trying to push through. With that, we'll recess to the call of the chair, expecting to be around 5:30, I believe, is what we have. So soon after session, be looking at your email and the listserv regarding that as well. And so with that, thank you so much for asking. We are in the basement hearing room, I believe. So plan the basement hearing room, unless other word. And so with that, we stand in recess. Thank you, members and members of the public.
All right. Okay, I'm hitting that anyway. We are reconvening. I'm reconvening the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division, and we are working through House File 1801. I had a question from Representative Damuth about procedure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as procedural, regarding adoption of the HF 2610 Division Report, this morning when we added the two amendments to the bill, were those amendments moved and adopted to the DE3 amendment? Or were they moved and adopted to the HF 2610 as amended by the DE3?
And Representative Dana, thank you for the question, and it was the latter. So to confirm, on Tuesday, the bill was brought before us. The DE amendment was offered and was at that time adopted. And so then the bill before us this morning was the bill as amended. So there's no separation between the bill and the DE amendment at that point. And so the amendments that we considered this morning and approved or rejected were amendments to the bill as amended. Follow-up question?
Okay. Okay. That'll be good. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, and if there are concerns, please do raise them. But so then the vote this morning was to approve the bill as amended. And so it had already been amended on Tuesday, and so then received further amendment this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so members, we're left with one amendment to House File 1801. It's the A9 amendment, and does someone wish to offer the A9 amendment?
Yes. Thank you.
Representative Franson, we'll call on you to offer and describe the A9 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I want a roll call on this as well.
And one having been requested, there will be a roll call.
Thank you. So the purpose of this amendment, friends, is to add some teeth to the anti-fraud measures in the DE6 amendments. The amendment addresses three critical points necessary to countering child care fraud. First, it clarifies for providers that their records and billing forms must be accurate and truthfully attested to, which is necessary for establishing intent in prosecutions, and you probably read some of that when you read your child care fraud from the OLA. Second, it expands on the consequences for fraud, and third, it removes the fraud investigation units from DHS oversight and control, which was also another recommendation from the OLA. This amendment includes provisions to place a notice on billing forms advising the liability for intentionally providing false information. It limits to 10% the number of child care slots a center can fill with children of employees receiving the child care assistance program. And you'll probably recall from discussion House File 497, and I took to heart the concerns raised to reducing that number to zero. Remember last week I said we could only go up, so we did. And requires providers and employees to sign a declaration at the time of authorization or reauthorization to receive the child care assistance program that the authorization is true and correct under the penalty of perjury. It allows counties to rescind provider authorization for up to 3 months for failing to meet reporting requirements and allows a penalty up to $1,000 who intentionally violates the reporting requirements. It also reduces the amount of time a provider has to submit billing from 60 to 30 days, requires notice on billing forms on liabilities for intentionally providing false information. It revokes parent aware reading from a provider disqualified from receiving child care assistance program reimbursements and makes those programs ineligible to receive early learning scholarships. Requires all licensors to report any suspected fraud. And finally, transfers the recipient and child care provider fraud units to the BCA effective January 1st, 2020, but allows them to remain located within DHS until January 1st, 2026. members, this is probably, besides the gas tax and the other taxes, this is probably the number one issue that constituents across the state are paying attention to. Any news reports that have come out, the comments are very, very clear that taxpayers are demanding accountability for their dollars. Every dollar invested in this program is important, and bringing integrity back into this, along with other public programs, is very crucial. And with that, I will allow for discussion or
okay.
Go straight to a vote.
Thank you, Representative Franson. So questions or discussions regarding the A9 amendment? Anyone? I'll maybe just start asking the second section, the amendments to subdivision 9A. Do we know that this can be done just technologically? And have you checked with the department on this? My understanding is that the 10% may be problematic. I guess also note that I think total license capacity. I don't know if we have a definition of that term available. My understanding is that that actually refers to square footage as opposed to children. But I could be wrong about that. But that I believe that is the case. So I'm just not sure that particular one, for example, really kind of works. But I'll let Representative Franson respond if she wishes.
Get some
input. Yeah, Representative Franson. Yeah, if anybody is able to help us, Mr. Burris or Mr. Berg. I suppose probably more likely Mr. Burris than Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair and members, I would have to defer to the department on that. I'm just not familiar with a couple of the questions that you're.
And I'll ask, Reverend Franz, did you know? See, it sounds like you don't know on your own. Okay, oh, Ms. Sommerfeld is, say she's on her way up. Okay. Ms. Sommerfeld, identify yourself for the record, and then if you can provide commentary regarding that question of that definition of total license capacity and then the kind of how doable this is technologically, 10%.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jennifer Sommerfeld, the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services. We used to have a percentage in law. A couple years ago, it was set at 50% of children that were enrolled in the center, and that is something we can't actually do in our MET2 system. We don't know how many kids are there at a given time. They're private pay children. So that's why we came back and changed it to 25 children a couple of years ago. We need an actual number to make it work in our system. And license capacity actually refers to how many children you can be licensed for to be in the center at one time, which is based on square footage and other things. So you might have a license capacity of 50 children, but you might have 70 children that go through your center if you're open extended hours. So that's a slightly different concept than what we would normally use for this. We would prefer a number of children of employees.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Sommerfeld. Representative Franson, more you have on that? Representative Franson, yeah.
Well, 10% is still better than zero.
And Representative Franson, it sounds like, though, 10% is not measurable under the current system. I may be wrong with that. Ms. Sommerfeld, can you confirm or deny that, just provide input on that?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we would not be able to enforce 10%. That's why we had to change it the last time around. Mm-hmm. There's no way for us to calculate a percentage, and that doesn't work in our system. So we would need a whole number.
Mr. Representative Franson, yeah, please.
I would say that we brought this bill forward and had a robust discussion on it last week, and it would have been nice to hear this because I don't recall this being part of the discussion that a percentage would not work.
And I don't know, Representative Franson, that a percentage was part of the proposal last week too. And it is, and I'll note it's. I do appreciate, and I think others do as well, your willingness to respond to those concerns that were expressed. It sounds like this particular version may not work, but yeah, Representative Franson, and I know Representative Heinsohn is going to get
sure.
it as well.
Well, if the amendment were adopted, because we're talking about many issues in this amendment, many fraud provisions, anti-fraud provisions, if the amendment were to be adopted, it can be fixed at the next stop, which would be HHS Finance.
Representative Heinsohn.
Thank you, sir. Yeah. Clarification.
Yeah,
Ms.
Please. Yeah.
I'm wondering how long ago was this difficulty discovered in terms of the percentage? Because it sounded like it was in statute at 50%. Did we operate for many years with that in the language? Did that change immediately? And then
has technology changed? Is there any chance that Minnesota IT or whoever manages this system could possibly come up with a solution?
Ms. Sommerfeld.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, I was not here when the number of 50% went in, but my understanding is it was a few years ago. It was not a long time ago. Previous to that, we didn't have a limit. But we started noticing a significant number of children of employees enrolled in centers, and so we came back with a proposal to set that number, and where things everything settled out with the legislature through negotiation was at 50%. Then we attempted to implement it and found that we were not able to do that. And some of the problem is that we just simply don't know how many children are enrolled in every center. We only know CCAP children. That's the only number we track. So there could be 10 CCAP children and 30 non-CCAP children. So it's hard for us to calculate that percentage. That's why we just need a whole number.
So Ms. Sommerfeld, like you're saying, that the 50% actually was not able to be enforced even when it was in place a couple years ago.
Correct.
It sort of got imposed, and then you found you weren't able to do it.
That is correct.
So, okay.
And that's why we came back with a number.
Okay. Representative Heintzman, you got a follow-up, it looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So clarification. I was hearing you say that your system limited your ability to enforce the 50%. So I need the clarification so I understand. Are we saying that it's unenforceable because of a software problem, or if it's unenforceable because folks simply can't do the math to make this calculation? I'm a little
or maybe a third possibility. It sounded like that the information necessary for the calculation is not available regardless of the software. But can you clarify, Ms. Sommerfeld, sort of what are those possibilities you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, I think it's both. Our system isn't able to do it, but we are also unable to get the number of children to calculate 50%. We don't have the information available to us about what the number of children enrolled in the center is, because there's capacity, right? So we know through licensing what a licensed capacity is, but we don't know at any given time how many children are there. So you could have a licensed capacity of 50, and you might have 30 children actually enrolled, and then the next month you might have 45, because things change in child care centers. So it's not something that we were able to implement ever after. I think it was put in place in 2015, and then I believe we came back in 2017 and changed it to 25 once we knew it couldn't be done.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is getting easier or harder. I think I just heard you say we don't know how many children are there, which also begins to open up a whole nother can of worms for me. I don't know that there's much point pushing further on this, Mr. Chair, because I'm actually having more questions as we go further along. I'm not sure whether
I think it's
the committee might be in terms of their concern relative to we not knowing how many children are there. That might be getting to maybe the heart of the problem.
Well, Representative Heisman, I think what I heard Ms. Sommerfeld say before, and it seemed like this is consistent, is that there's information available about the number of CCAP children, but not necessarily the total number of children. I see her nodding. I feel like that's I heard her say that several times, and so I don't know that there's that I necessarily heard a difference or a change. But if there's additional questions you have, that's what I'm hearing, is that the department has the information regarding the CCAP children, but not necessarily children, the total number of children. So
that's correct, Mr. Chair. Our CCAP system does not track non-CCAP children. We only capture NMEC-2, which is our billing technology program that we use. We only track children that are in CCAP. We have no reason to track children who are not. So there is no way for us to do that proportion in our system.
It sounds like it's a CCAP system tracking CCAP kids, not tracking non-CCAP kids, and that's the challenge, it sounds like. But Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity, but I don't know that my question can be answered.
Okay,
so
maybe right now.
I just comparing what we're hearing to what I've read in the OLA report in regards to not being able to find some accurate information regarding the kids that are in the program. Maybe Representative Franzen has that in front of her. I don't. So.
Okay, Representative Franzen.
Thank you. So on page 19 of the OLA report, the last paragraph, Ramsey County, however, prosecuted a complex case involving a multi-layered scheme outside the typical scam of inflating the numbers of children who attended the child care center. In that case, centers recruited mothers to enroll their children in exchange for working at the center. The owners paid the mothers to essentially watch their own children. In addition, the centers falsified pay stubs and documents to make it appear to authorities that the mothers were working more hours than they actually were. The owners then profited from the difference in what they received in the child care assistance payments and what they paid in wages. So this is just what we're trying to get to the heart of the matter here, because let's just say there's another case next year or whatever, and that problem still is existing, Mr. Chair and members, taxpayers are going to look once again at us and say, hey, this was addressed in report after report, and you guys still didn't address it. So I guess, Mr. Chair, that's what we're trying to get to here, right? And this is the committee where we can work on these issues, and hopefully the department can come up with some advice here, because ultimately not only are the taxpayers pointing at us, but DHS is under a microscope too, and I suppose that's not very fun right now either. So if we could all just work together on this topic and show the taxpayers that, yes, indeed, we are really digging into this and bringing integrity and closing the loopholes of what some not so very nice people are scamming from us.
And Representative Franzen, we definitely should continue working on this. I will note that what you've cited from the OLA report is, in fact, a successful prosecution and a series of them they're referenced. I mean, it's a case where, in fact, you know, the law worked, which is not to say there's not we shouldn't continue to examine each of these provisions. But I will just note that in that case it did work. I want to make sure that we and we'll Representative Franzen get the last word on the full amendment. I did want to move to the next section and just ask a couple questions. The declaration of penalty. Line 2.9 says references each child care provider receiving reimbursement and having to sign, but the definition of provider, which actually it's on page 8 of the DE6. This is the one section that was not going to be removed from the earlier amendment that was offered by the minority. Provider means a center or facility. It's not an individual. So an organization, an entity, can't actually sign a declaration. I guess I'll also notice, too, the next line says that all employees of the provider have to sign. So I guess I just have a concern about having every single employee of a child care provider, whatever their role, signing this declaration. And I'm also not sure, looking down line 2.17, 2.20, I'm just not sure that is even would be allowed under the law to say that a verification upon oath or affirmation is basically like a sworn oath in front of a notary, but this is saying that when you sign it without a notary, it somehow constitutes that. I'm not actually sure that that's even allowable under the law. So I guess I have concerns about that particular section, about how that would even work and kind of the necessity for it, and as I say, even just how that would even work. Before moving on to another section, I'll allow if anybody wants to, Representative Franzen, or anybody else wants to either respond to that or anything regarding that one. But I'm just not quite understanding it.
Well, I'm sure this entire amendment, it sounds like you have major concerns about, Mr. Chair.
Representative Franzen. I guess I'll keep moving. The next section, I'm just can Representative Franzen, or perhaps with the assistance of House Research, to just explain what's going on in this next section about part-time attendance. Just kind of make sure that we're all tracking. And Mr. Burris, I can come back to you if you'd like. It's maybe putting you a little bit on the spot here.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I need to
okay.
Review it a little.
Okay, no problem. And then I want to jump to page 5, lines 5.18 to 5.20. So this is mandatory report by licensors if there is, quote, suspected fraud to, quote, the appropriate authorities. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out, so who is the appropriate authorities under this proposal, this line 5.20, the sense, I guess, or maybe I don't need to necessarily ask the question. I'll let Representative France or anybody else respond. I'm just concerned about what the definition of suspected fraud is and appropriate authorities, what the penalty to this might be, and kind of why we would stop it. Licensors, I guess I have a lot of concerns with this, but I see Representative Bonner has a question or comment. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in subdivision 9, line 2.27, it says, so we're requiring billing when when it falls to less than half of the child authorized hours or days for a four-week period. I guess the first question would be, under what circumstances might a child's attendance drop below half of their authorized hours, and how frequently might that occur in a general setting?
You may have stumped a number of us, Representative Bonner. I think Mr. Burris was still working through that section, so we may need to let him finish up a bit. I guess the mandated reporting section, I'll just to go back to that. I generally speaking, when there's a mandated report, so you know, we have a system where we certainly expect individuals to report when they're aware of wrongdoing. We keep mandated report, like a legal mandated report where there's a consequence or penalty to not doing it, to situations, and I'm real familiar with this with my other work, when there's some kind of vulnerability, physical abuse, sexual abuse, et cetera, a child or a vulnerable adult who would not be in position to report themselves, or there'd be some reason to think that somebody would be reluctant to report because of the sensitive nature of the situation. I certainly would expect that if a licensor suspected fraud or wrongdoing, that they would report that. Imposing a particular requirement in statute for that, though, does raise a lot of questions about, as I said, what the consequence is, why we stop at the licensor level, why not say all county employees or even all people, and then how they kind of know that a situation involves suspected fraud, the terms are not defined. So I guess I have significant concerns with that section as well. And I guess I'll then move on to the last section, which I recognize the move of the investigation unit to the BCA. I recognize as something that was suggested in a letter that was sent by the Office of Legislative Auditor. I actually only received it just the other day, and so I need to be looking at that and seeing further. But I have to say that I have that in general, I don't think that is a good idea. I'm happy to talk further and understand further the thinking of that from the OLA, but the fact is that the investigations that happen within DHS in these situations start off, and appropriately so, as civil matters. I'm well aware that when something moves criminal, it tends to take a lot longer. It's a lot higher standard. We absolutely should do it when it meets the standard. But a lot of the time, what you end up doing is addressing issues, and appropriately so, via the civil process. And the thought that we're going to be moving that unit to the BCA, which is strictly criminal, they then have to reach back to be connecting with folks within the department when, again, a lot of that work is civil. And I'll point out that the Commerce Department, the Department of Revenue, both have investigators who, again, handle civil matters that sometimes become criminal and are within their departments, and they're not getting moved over to the BCA. I work a lot with BCA agents, and the thought that it does not seem appropriate to me to move this investigations unit, both civil and criminal, over to the BCA. And so I guess I have great concerns with that as well. I saw Representative Bonner back on the list. So Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify, where I was headed with my questions on that Section 9. I guess I was thinking of, I know, even in my own family, there's cases where, one of the kiddos gets sick, and, we might have them go spend time with grandma for a week or two while they're getting over being sick, and might not have them in child care. Or it's pretty common in my family. We might send one of the kiddos off to go visit their cousins for a couple of weeks or something. And I guess what I'm trying to get at here is I'm curious about under the circumstances under which this would happen, and how often that might happen. And I know we've talked a lot about trying to be very conscientious about not adding additional layers or burden on some of our child care providers. And I would really hate to see them adding additional layers of red tape on top for things like, if a child goes to visit their cousins for 2 weeks, do we really want them filing a report for that? I mean, that seems burdensome to the child care provider, and maybe not, that it might not add a lot of value, particularly when, so I guess I'm trying to understand what this provision is getting at, what it's trying to do, because I'm not feeling like it might be reaching the intended purpose.
Okay. Representative Franson.
Okay, so thank you, Representative Bonner. Remember that
they are already required to do this by law, okay, on the reporting required for a child's part-time attendance. They're already required to do that. My new language in there just provides the penalties for not doing what is already required by law. Right here.
Okay. Mr. working on that.
Yep. So line 2.25, that's now paragraph A.
Okay. I think we're going to be getting, so Mr. Burris is working through that too. Looks like you're, Mr. Burris, you're ready to talk perhaps? Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, as Representative Franson pointed out, current law is the requirement that you see 2.25 to 2.29. So that's all what's required as far as reporting on the part of child care providers when the attendance falls under this threshold over a four-week period. And then the amendment would propose to add two types of penalties for a provider who fails to report. First, it would authorize the county to rescind authorization if there's a kind of reason to believe that the failure to report occurred. That would be for up to 3 months. And then the second penalty would be an administrative penalty that could be imposed by either the department or the county of $1,000, and that would be for intentional violations of that failure to report.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cortese-Witton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Franzen, in line 3.2, where it says the county knows or has reason to believe that the provider has not yet met the reporting requirements, what type of reason to believe are we talking about there? Because I can see where that might be a little bit fuzzy, and I just want to make sure that there, like you're trying to add some teeth. I just want to make sure that there's not any unintended consequences that a provider might lose their authorization for some such as kind of a misunderstanding.
Representative Franson.
Thank you. As I said, we already have this in law, right? So we're just providing the extra penalties to say, hey, there's going to be some teeth here, and we're addressing the fraud, remember? So we're getting into the minutia of, ooh, we really don't really want to do this. I don't like this language. But remember, taxpayers are paying attention, and here they are, see us all, like, arguing about how we're going to address the fraud, and they're not seeing much action being taken.
Representative Cortese-Witton.
I guess that didn't really answer my question. So it says, has reason to believe. What does that mean?
Representative Franson.
Exactly how it sounds.
Representative Cortese-Witton.
So any reason?
Well, if they expect it, I guess, thank you, Mr. Chair, sorry, see something, say something, right? So, and if it finds out that, you know, it was a mistake, then it was a mistake. But I'm pretty sure that we can trust the process to work itself out.
Representative Cortese-Witton.
Okay. I appreciate the clarification.
And I want to note, I mean, because we're kind of doing this through the amendment process, but recognizing that there are just a ton of efforts and measures to improve and ensure program integrity in the bill itself, recognizing that improving data analytics to identify when there's fraud, when there's some kind of misuse of funds, and making sure that there's the ability to identify and bring in evidence in court. Of course, we have the administrative law hearings, the adjustment of the standard of proof, and we've discussed that before, and really a wide variety of points. And so just in terms of, to the extent that there is concern from folks to ensure the integrity of the program, there's a lot that is in the bill as it stands, which I think is part of the reason that you may be getting some narrow questions about some of these particular proposals, because in fact there's just a ton that's going on as it is. So I'll take things in order. So Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Franson, I just wanted to clarify paragraph B and C. So paragraph C has intentionally violates, and I just wanted to clarify if intentionality was also included in B, or if that would just be they're not meeting the reporting requirements, period, or if they're intentionally not meeting the reporting requirements. I just was seeking a little bit of clarification on if that's the same in both B and C, or if it's different for B.
Representative Franson.
I think I'll refer to.
Okay. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, I guess one thing I would note in looking at or kind of comparing between B and C on the intentionality is how that establishes something of a standard for whether an administrative penalty would hold. And so an accidental failure to report would be arguably somewhat harder to, well, let me put it a little bit differently. Intentionality sets a kind of higher threshold for imposing the penalty and having that hold up, whereas, and that's in paragraph C, whereas the language as I read it in paragraph B would be authority on the basis of the county based on their knowledge and not what what demonstration of intent has been established as far as what the provider's failure to report had been.
Okay. And I am, as I'm looking, so if we look at the DE6 amendment, if folks don't mind, on page 39, I actually think that a lot of this may already be addressed in the amended bill, because recognizing we do have, per Representative Davis' question before, this is actually the amended House File 1801 at this point, but it's the document in front of us that we can just look at, the one labeled DE6. Line 39.9 to 39.10, I believe that this is actually addressing what's being discussed. If there's a failure to report a decrease in attendance, then there's the three-month withhold that can be in there, which is consistent. It's slightly different, but addresses quite a bit of this. There's not the $1,000 administrative penalty, which I guess in my view, what's in the bill currently should be sufficient. You've got you're getting your payment withhold, the wrongdoer's payment withhold for that period of time, and in fact, the wrongdoing in question is a failure to report decrease in attendance, which is wrong, and there should be that in there. But to my mind, the language in 39.11 to 39.13 should address that. Any other comments on or questions regarding the A9 amendment? And then we'll certainly make sure Representative France gets the last word. Representative Pryor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at beginning on line 3.21, the quality rating and improvement system. And then the section after that about the scholarships, and that, you know, as I read it, the understanding that if someone has committed fraud, that they would not be able to be a rated program and they would not be able to receive scholarships. And I'm wondering if we could use a division and just vote on that separately. And I think, you know, maybe some of the language might be changed, but especially the date, July 1st, 2019, may not be feasible to put into effect. But if it's possible to do a division, then we could just vote on that part separately.
Okay, Representative Pryor, you're requesting the amendment be divided, and I think into three parts. So the first part, ending at line 3.18, is what I'm understanding you to be saying.
Yes.
The second part, running from lines 3.19 to 5.16, and then the third part from lines 5.17 until the end. So first, am I understanding that request correctly?
Yes, yeah. That makes sense
motion,
to me.
Yeah, or that motion, okay.
That motion, yes.
Okay. And as I... Yeah, so let's have Mr. Burris repeat the division for us, make sure we're all on the same page.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I have for the division that the first portion of the amendment would run from the beginning, so 1.3 in effect to 3.18. The second portion would run from 3.19 to 5.16, and then the third portion would run from 5.17 to 6.2.
Oh.
With kind of an implicit reviser's instructions accordingly.
So it seems to me that the amendment is in fact divisible in that way. I don't know if I seek an opinion from Mr. Burris regarding that. I think often that's the case. Is that something that House Research generally opines upon, Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair and members, no.
Okay.
It's something more of a parliamentary question that and House Research and House Fiscal aren't parliamentarians for the committee.
Good call, Mr. Burris, in terms of not being parliamentarians. Then I am going to rule that the amendment is divisible in that way. So I want to make sure to allow the amendment, the proposer of the amendment, and now the three amendments to have the last word on them. I guess I have some concerns regarding the language in that second one as well. I kind of skipped over that as we went through, but as Representative Pryor alluded to, that maybe something could be addressed as the pieces move forward. So. So Representative Franson.
So could you just explain, like, what part of the amendment we're on now?
So what's happened is that Representative Pryor has moved to divide the amendment into the three parts described by Mr. Burris. I've ruled that the amendment is, in fact, divisible in that way. And so why don't we take the three parts simply in order then? And so we'll do the first discussion and vote on the first amendment, first part.
So
Representative Franson.
Representative Pryor gets to decide what.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay. All right. Clearly, I'm not. Representative Pryor. Sorry.
Please make the motion.
And thank you, Representative.
You're going to say that we would vote on the first part.
I was just thinking that we would do it just simply in line order, Representative Pryor. Let's. We certainly will. Yeah. So so we will have final discussion and vote on. The first part, which is lines 1.3 to lines 3.18. I'm going to go to Representative Franson last. Any further questions or discussions regarding that amendment? I'm going to go to Representative Franson. I'm going to let you go last anyway, but yeah.
Right. So just roll call on each one of the.
There'll be a roll call. The roll call will be requested on each part of the amendment. There will be. I will simply note the concerns that I had said before about a number of pieces of this. And Representative Franson will give you the last word on that first amendment. And I will repeat just before we vote about exactly what we're voting on, too. Representative Franson.
I guess I'll just say this for the entire amendment, Mr. Chair. I do believe that there was I think you mentioned something about the OLA. And, the OLA was in front of the Senate discussing the report. And sadly, the OLA was not in front of our committee where we could flush these questions out and have a more robust discussion than, me trying to put together an amendment that deals specifically with the OLA. And I think that that kind of has been a disservice, I think, to the entire committee. Something just to note for, I think you're doing an excellent job as a chair, maybe for next year. Because there's going to be another report coming out soon, too, about the integrity of the other public programs.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Franson. Yeah, and I certainly want to continue to encourage folks. I've got my well-read copy of the report. I encourage folks to do that, too, and to continue. Let's continue to be working on this. So the first vote is on the A9 amendment from lines 1.3 to lines 3.18, and the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Cattiz Watun, Vice Chair.
No.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Damath.
Yes.
Representative Heinzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
No.
Representative Pryor.
No.
Representative Wazalek.
No.
Representative West.
There being three votes in favor and six against, the motion fails and this portion of the A9 amendment is not adopted. So moving to the next portion, lines, we're voting on lines 3.19 to 5.16, pardon me, lines 3.19 to lines 5.16. Any additional questions or discussions? We had Representative Franson's point on the last one, which I assume continues to both of these, but anything else further? Representative Pryor, yeah.
Right. And, I mean, just to reiterate, I think that we're in agreement that if someone has been found not to be eligible for CCAP for something, actions that they have taken, they certainly wouldn't be someone I would call a four-star rating. So I think that makes sense. And also the scholarships. So I think that if you're violating the public trust and not conducting your business in a way that's that follows the rules, that you should not be able to take money for these other programs either, or even to be get that acknowledgement of being having a star rating. But that being said, though, I think it may be that the language still needs to be adjusted to make sure that I understand that is the intent of the amendment, but that in the report as it goes forward, some of the language, including the date, might be changed afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so with that, I'll have the clerk take the roll on the second portion of the A9 amendment.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Yes.
Representative Katizawatun, Vice Chair.
Yes.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Damath.
Yes.
Representative Heintzman.
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
Yes.
Representative Pryor.
Yes.
Representative Wasilek.
Yes.
Representative West.
On a vote of 9 yeses and no nays, the motion passes and the second part of the A9 amendment is adopted. Representative Franson pulls it together again. And then the final portion of the A9 amendment, this is from lines 5.17 to line 6.2, recognizing those last two lines are implied revisor's instructions, as Mr. Burris referenced. And then any further questions or comments regarding this, recognizing Representative Franson's earlier comment applies to this as well. Mm-hmm. And so with that, I'll ask the clerk to take the roll on the – oh, Mr. Representative Franson.
Absolutely, please. I want to just let everybody know that it's on page 29 of your OLA report, discussing the independence of the DHS Inspector General. This isn't some new idea either. There is a Washington Post article, and it's titled, As Inspectors General Are Celebrated, VA Tried to Intimidate Its IG. And this is related, dated July 10th, 2018, where at that time, Representative Tim Walz, he called the letter an unprecedented attack. The top Democrat on the House VA committee said in a statement, "Never before have I seen such an explicit attempt by a senior government official to curtail an active IG investigation." Mr. O'Rourke, nobody is above the law, and it is not for you to decide when or where the VA OIG exercises its investigative authority. Members, I am very concerned about the workplace atmosphere at the OIG and making sure that our investigators are given the autonomy to do the job that they need to do without retaliation from the Department of Human Services. I feel that it is very important for us to move that team out under the BCA. They don't actually have to move locations. They would stay at the DHS, so they would have access to the licensors division and SIRS and the other things that they need. But I am going to continue pushing on this. I will be having conversations with DPS as well as the BCA about how we can make this move happen. But this is probably, if anything gets done on this topic, this is, I believe, our number one issue is to move this team out and into the BCA. And we talk about, you know, in other areas of government or in the private sector of toxic work atmosphere and how, you know, in certain workplaces that should not be tolerated. It should not be tolerated in our own government as well, especially when we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars at stake. Seriously, this is just something that we need to come together on and come up with a bipartisan approach on how to get the independence.
And Representative Franson, I recognize the OLA recommendation regarding independence, and in the report itself, they don't reference going to the BCA, but of course, in a subsequent letter, it does. And I recognize and understand your concerns about this, and know that they are sincere and well held, et cetera. I guess if the concern is there being a problem within the work environment, it doesn't seem like having an independence is exactly the right way to deal with that. The way to deal with that, because then you've still got whatever's left inside, if that is in fact a problem. So as I've been trying to think this through, I guess it seems to me that exploring the idea of independence makes a lot of sense. It's something we need to look at. This is not actually what this amendment does, just to be clear, right? This is kind of a separate point. It's related to independence, but it's actually put it's then inside of a different department, so it's separate from DHS, but then it's inside of a different department. So I think that's a little different than what was suggested in terms of having the OIG actually be independent from any agency. But I think it's worth looking at. I would love to continue working with you in a bipartisan way and doing it. The one piece that I know, the thing in front of us right now, is that having a move to the BCA, to my mind, does not make sense for the reasons that I said before. And we'll just, you know, continue to probably to disagree on that, but would love to continue to talk about other ways to make this investigations unit be as effective as possible. Is there anything you want to add, please feel free to, and otherwise we'll, okay, nothing. All right, so then we're moving on to the vote on the third part of the A9 amendment from lines 5.17 to the end. And Madam Clerk, please take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
No.
Representative Katizawatuin, Vice Chair.
No.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Damath. Representative Heinzman?
Yes.
Representative Morrison?
No.
Representative Pryor?
No.
Representative Wasilek?
No.
Representative West?
There being three in favor and six against, the motion fails. The amendment is, that portion of the amendment is not adopted. And with that, members, we are to House File 1801 as amended, both the other day and then today. Any discussion to House File 1801 as amended?
I just have
Representative France.
Mr. Chair, I just have final comments if there's no.
Yeah, well, there may be. So let's wait. Does anybody have anything that they wish to say regarding House File 1801? Quiet group. Representative Katizawatuin, you look okay. All right. I guess you do. Representative Katizawatuin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to express my appreciation to everyone on the committee for their consideration of all the issues so far this session, and I'm appreciative of the amendment that we were able to come together on today, and I think that we're putting forward a bill that's going to address some of the issues that we're seeing in the program, and I think that we, like I mentioned earlier this morning, this is going to be a great start to improving upon the current status of not only CCAP, but just the early childhood arena for families across the state in general. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And I think we'll Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to reiterate some of the points that Representative Katizawatuin made this morning. And I think there's a lot of really good provisions within this bill that I think really enhance things for our youngest learners. I also actually want to thank Representative Franzen for a robust discussion on fraud, and I think that certainly everyone in this room agrees that we want every dollar to go where it's meant to go, and every dollar that doesn't means that there's one more child that we could have helped that didn't get that help. Not only that, as representatives of our districts and of the state of Minnesota, I think we all take very seriously the idea that we want to make sure we're good stewards of the people's money, and that's really important. I think we agree with that. And I look forward to looking for some additional ways in which we can work together to do better.
Thank you. And then to the minority lead, and then I'll conclude since it's my bill for this one. So Representative Franson.
Thank you, and I have a feeling that the discussion on fraud does not end tonight.
So. I think you may well be right.
So, Mr. Chair, members, when the OLA report was released, we learned that the child care assistance program fraud is real and more pervasive than the agency was willing to admit, and not limited to just fraudulent billing or employment scams, but also includes failure to provide the services required. As I noted in previous comments to the committee, the table was set for fraud, and while there are some efforts in this bill to reset that table, this bill still falls well short of what is needed to take the scope of the fraud seriously. While this bill establishes and increases criminal penalties for fraud, it does not give prosecutors the tools they need to prove intent to commit fraud. And while the administrative consequences appear to be strengthened in this bill, there are still too many loopholes for providers to evade responsibility and for the commissioner to simply let them off the hook. This bill dumps tens of millions of new taxpayer dollars into the child care assistance program that taxpayers are rightfully questioning its integrity. And this bill has a chance to do what is best for the children, their parents, as well as the hardworking, honest providers whose reputations are jeopardized when the entire program remains in questions. Mr. Chair, I thank you, your staff, and my colleagues for the hard work that went into this bill. But at this time, I cannot support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative Franzen. And thanks, everyone, for the discussion both tonight and over the last couple months. I think we can all, each one of us, be proud of having focused attention on this issue. And by this issue, I mean early childhood, this area in general. I think we all can agree that we want to make sure that every child gets off to a great start and that we are facing some significant challenges in doing that, both the opportunity gaps that we see at every stage of life in economics and employment and in health, and also the child care challenges that families are experiencing that then are having ripple effects for employers, et cetera. These two bills today really are a great start on the great start on that great start vision, and I'm grateful to each of you for your work in that. We have investments in home visiting, in early care and learning, in a variety of forms to meet families' needs, including child care assistance, including early learning scholarships, and including the voluntary pre-kindergarten program, and then all kinds of other pieces as well. And in doing so, we are driving forward hard to ensure the integrity of each one of these programs, recognizing that a critical part of a program's integrity is having that program actually be fully funded rather than having kids and families be waiting and languishing, as is true in so many of these areas, which have been historically so underfunded. We're taking a step to rectify that today, and I'm really glad that we're doing so. And I guess maybe this is actually a really appropriate time to thank, in particular, our partisan staff, and Mr. Withers, and we've got Mr. Sullivan here, but we've got Mr. Durheim and Mr. Beltran de Rudquist, I think I'm saying that right, yeah, who've done amazing work. But I really have, and Mr. Benjamin and Mr. Fennec for assisting us. I have to, though, because we're going to be back together again, members, in some form. This will be our last regularly scheduled meeting, but I have got to call out the nonpartisan staff, because they're amazing. Mr. Berg is here. Ms. Adrians is not. Mr. Burris, I just need to make sure everyone recognizes that he handles health and human services with us, education, and transportation all at the same time, and has done incredible work. I assume that he's been as helpful to the minority as he's been to me as chair and to members of the majority. I'm really grateful. With that, though, we're going to take the roll on House File 1801. And to be referred, 1801 as amended, for referral to HHS Finance. Madam Clerk, please take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Yes.
Representative Katisa Watun, Vice Chair.
Yes.
Representative Franzen.
No.
Representative Bonner.
Yes.
Representative Damath.
No.
Representative Heinzman.
No.
Representative Morrison.
Yes.
Representative Pryor.
Yes.
Representative Wasilek.
Yes.
Representative West.
There being six in favor and three against, the motion passes. House File 1801, as amended, is referred to the HHS Finance Division. Again, thank you so much to everyone. This is our last regularly scheduled meeting. I know that we will have others, I suspect, in the coming weeks, and then certainly want to be in touch with the interim. There's a lot of issues that have been raised, members, and I have to say I feel like our discussions have gotten more and more thoughtful and more interesting over the course of the session. And please know to each member that I would really like to continue those conversations with you. And sometimes it's those one-on-one conversations that could get us some really interesting places, and please continue that. Representative Franzen, yes.
So I have some exciting comments to make, too.
Oh, please.
This is probably our last meeting for a little bit, okay?
Yeah, please, yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, members, I want to thank each of you on your work for as chair of the division. Mr. Chair, I think you did an excellent job. And while we have not agreed on every procedural matter, I believe that you you did everything you could to be fair-minded, and for that I want to thank you and thank your staff. And Mr. Benjamin, I think you have a beautiful smile, too. So you're welcome. No, but he did get a video shout-out once. So. With that said, I do regret this division did not take our oversight authority a little bit more seriously. The division did hold 18 meetings, and we mentioned that last week before finally hearing from anyone in a real position of authority from the Department of Human Services regarding the problems at the OIG and the extensive fraud within the child care assistance program. And I think that has done a little bit of a disservice to our committee and to the entire state. when the minority brought forward a motion to seek a subpoena for Ms. Carolyn Hamm, you used a point of order to dismiss the motion and then denied our members the right to appeal your ruling. And shortly following our efforts to seek a subpoena, Ms. Hamm was placed on investigative leave, and we may not hear from her now, which is tragic. And but with that all said, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you again for your work. It's been a great committee. I want to thank all of the staff as well. You know, we haven't had too many late night meetings, and I think that's great. And we also had a good time, and everybody was very respectful toward one another, and I appreciate that. And I want to also thank the nonpartisan staff for the great work that you provide as well. Mr. Burress, I've had you doing cartwheels on different amendments, and same with Emily, but can't pronounce your last name. But anyway, I want to thank everybody for their hard work and effort, so thanks.
And Representative Franzen, thank you so much for the passion that you bring to this and the experience and expertise. I think I referenced that in the very first meeting, and that's been true all the way along. And I hope that we can build on this. I know that we will build on this work over interim and then certainly next year as well. But I suspect that this is not our last meeting in the next few weeks. I think that there'll be opportunities that will arise as well. I think that Representative Katisa Witun wanted to say something.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, since we won't be having 8 o'clock in the morning meetings anymore, if Representative Franzen might lead us in a CrossFit class one of these days.
She's Representative Franzen.
CrossFit Timberwolf. They've got a 7 a.m. class.
One thing I do want to note is that if we do have another meeting, I'm going to do everything I can to not have it be at 8 in the morning. I think we discovered that very few of us are morning people. I am certainly not. So that will, I'm going to do anything that I can to avoid that.
Actually, we could take a motion for that.
I believe
we probably would all agree on that.
Yeah. we could have a motion to request that Ways and Means Director. too close to home. Thank you. Too soon. That's exactly right. Members, thank you so much, and staff, and members of the audience who stuck with us all the way through. With that, we are adjourned.